wild strawberry for about 8 years, and it's been really exciting to work on a horticulture crop. And also, as you can see, that wild strawberry is a really good model system to study important questions in food development. So, wild strawberry or Fusarium vesca has many advantages as a model or emerging model. It has a sequence genome. Actually, recently, a high-quality sequence genome is published, and it's really nice to have a high-quality genome. It has a small genome size, and most importantly, it's diploid. So compared with the cultivated strawberry, which is octopoid, and the wild strawberry is diploid, which is really facilitating genetic analysis and identification of important genes, and then try to transfer the knowledge of those genes into cultivated strawberry. In addition, it can be transformed, although not so easy. You have to say it takes about 9 to 12 months. And it's kind of small, you grow in growth chambers, and you can propagate it asexually, which facilitates the speed, and also you can keep the genotype very easily. And also, it can serve as a model system for non-cooked bacteria food. So, strawberry is a very interesting food in itself. The receptacle is actually the flesh food. The real food, what's called a botanical food, is called a cheek, which are those little red dots on the surface of the receptacle. And each cheek has a single seed inside. So in some way, you can see the strawberry food as an inside-out food because the seeds are exposed on the outside. That's why a strawberry has a long history as a model system to study food development because of easy access of those those seeds on the outside. So as early as 1950, Professor Nish did experiment to show the important role of auxin in food initiation of food sets. So what he did is that he removed all the cheek except one. Then you'll see only a small flesh surrounding that one cheek developed into the food flesh. Or if he removed everything else except three cheek, then you get three little flesh underneath. This indicates that the food initiation requires a substance coming from the cheek. Later on, he showed that the substance is auxin because if you remove all, so this is a wild, a normal strawberry, but if you remove all the cheek, there is no flesh development, a full flesh development. But then when you apply, after you remove the cheek, you apply auxin, then you can get a full strawberry. So suggesting it's very likely this cheek is producing auxin, which then stimulate underneath flesh to develop. So even though that experiment was done in the 1950s, very little is known in terms of the molecular processes underneath that observation. So we started to look at that question and trying to, because we have the tools nowadays, we are using the genomic tool, trying to understand the molecular events underneath that communication between the cheek and so we started out using this Fusarium vesca to demonstrate the same thing that happened in the wild strawberry. So here is a wild strawberry without fertilization. So they stay small after 15 days. But if you have this emasculated food that you supply with GA or auxin, you can stimulate the food to grow. But if you combine GA and auxin, then you can get a food that is almost the same size as a pollinated food. So suggesting both auxin and GA are important to stimulate food initiation. So that means that if we apply these two hormones, we may be able to produce a fertilization-independent food initiation, or we call plasma carbon food development, which I think has agricultural importance because sometimes the pollination is a problem. So if you can figure out a molecular switch to switch from the food initiation program, then you can go result of fertilization. So you can increase food yield even under harsh environmental conditions, such as a lack of pollinator or high temperature that inactivate the pollen. So having established that it works in the wild strawberry, we went on to produce RNA seq to look at the transcriptomes underneath various tissues of the food and doing five different developmental stages of food development. So we dissected open the strawberry and so we have the receptacle, which is the precursor to the food, fresh food. And we also divide the receptacle into a piece, which is the middle, and then cortex surrounding this. And then we also isolated the 18 and we dissected the 18 into three tissues. One is the ovary wall, which surrounds the seed. One is the seed, but then we open up the seed and we divide the seed into the embryo tissue and what's left, which is basically endosperm and simple. And that's called ghost tissue. So we have five tissues, ovary wall, embryo, ghost, and the piece and the cortex. So then we isolate RNA and do the RNA seq and get this transcriptome data and all our data are now stored in this website, Strawberry Genome Resource. Anybody can access the website and download the RNA seq data. In this website, there's quite a lot of information. For instance, you can go in and just see browse to see all our RNA seq data, and which would be helpful to actually annotate the gene. If you have every gene, you can go in and see all the RNA read in different stages, which can allow you to see alternative splicing. So having generated this data, and now we're ready to answer the questions I posed earlier about auxin, the role of auxin and GA in food initiation. So what we did is that we pulled out all the genes involved in auxin and GA biosynthesis, and then you can see that across different stages in different food tissues. And here's the receptacle tissue, the piece and the cortex. As you can see, that there's not much expression of the genes involved in GA and auxin biosynthesis, but in contrast, in the 18, especially in the tissue ghost, which is the endosperm and sequel tissue, you see a much higher expression of the biosynthetic genes involved in GA and auxin biosynthesis. So this supports the observation early on where the 18 is actually the site of auxin and the GA biosynthesis. Further, it provides more resolution, tissue resolution, showing that the biosynthesis site is probably in the endosperm tissue. But if you look at the genes involved in auxin signaling, which are the downstream of the auxin biosynthesis, so these are signaling genes, particularly here from genes involved, genes called ARF genes, auxin responsive factors, or IAA genes, these are transcription factors. You can see the transcription factors in contrast to biosynthesis genes. The transcription factors are reduced in the receptacle tissue. So which means that the auxin synthesized in the 18 must somehow get transported in the receptacle and initiate or activate the downstream signaling events to promote the food initiation, food enlargement, and finally food ripening. So that was really interesting. Right? Then we can do this kind of a bioinformatic analysis, we can find important genes that may be involved in auxin biosynthesis during food initiation, and also genes that may be involved in auxin perception, and then so we can go on to find the gene function, like pick the genes and study their function. So we first just pick the two genes. One is a GA1, which is a gene involved in auxin biosynthesis. Another gene called ARF8, which is involved in auxin response. So our hypothesis is that if you knock out this gene, say auxin biosynthesis, then you should be able to perform food initiation because there's no auxin made, there'll be no food initiation. But if you can, if let's say ARF8, if it's a repressor of food development, then if you are able to, so this is a transcription factor, so if you knock out this gene, you may get automatic food development. In other words, you may be able to get positive carbon food development. So those are the hypotheses. But then we need to have a way to knock out or knock down the genes. So we pick the So we use CRISPR to knock out those genes. Probably all of you know how CRISPR works. I go very fast about this slide. So CRISPR basically really introduced a Cas9, which is the enzyme and DNA nuclease. But then this enzyme needs a couple of the guide RNA. So this green is the guide RNA. In particular, this part of the guide RNA can have a sequence that's complementary to the gene of your interest. In blue here, so if there's a fit, there's a complementarity, then this guide RNA will bring the enzyme complex to the target sequence in blue here, and then it makes double-stranded cuts. So once it cuts double-stranded target DNA, the cell will respond to this double-stranded cut using a resisting repair system. So there are two alternative ways to repair this double-stranded break. One is going through this NHEJ repairing.
Is it called? Yeah,
NHEJ repairing system, and it will just kind of join the breaking ends together, and usually it leads to insertion of deletions at the site of cutting. Alternatively, if you provide the cell with a good template, and for instance, you can provide a template that has a desirable nucleotide in it. So then the cell will use this template to repair the DNA. As a result, the newly introduced base pair can be introduced in the final sequence. So you can actually correct mutations or introduce, you can introduce missense mutations to the target gene. So to start out, we just wanted to see whether we can knock out using this system, knock out the gene. So we developed vectors for strawberry genome editing. Because we don't know whether the guide RNA can be expressed by a rhodopsin promoter, so we actually cloned a U6 promoter from strawberry and drive expression of the guide RNA. Then we have another one using the rhodopsin promoter drive guide RNA. So we have this dual sgRNA system. So you can use two guide RNA, and both of guide RNA usually target the same gene. We're hoping that if both are both guide RNA can successfully cut the target and get to getting a deletion in the target. So then we introduce this URNA into a vector which has the Cas9 already there, which is driven by a ubiquitin promoter. So then we transform this vector into strawberry. So strawberry transformation is like many of the other transformations where you use the agrobacteria to introduce the Cas9 into the strawberry calyx, and then you try to encourage the calyx to produce a shoot, transgenic shoot, and finally, when this transgenic shoot moves, and then you move it in the soil. So that's what we call T0 generation transgenic plants. And then if we can collect seeds from this T0 generation, when these seeds grow up, we call this plant T1 generation. So first, so basically, this is the first generation, second generation transgenic. And in the next few slides, I'll tell you our results of analyze both the T1 generation both the T0 generation and T1 generation. So so in the T0 generation, basically the primary transgenic plants, we use this PCR to show that these are indeed transgenic plants. We PCR the Cas9 to make sure the plants all have the Cas9 gene in them. So then we load this. A number of transgenic plants, different lines. Then we, once we know they're transgenic, we use PCR to amplify the target sequence. So in this case, TAA1, and in this case, ARF8. So we're able to PCR amplify the target gene and sequence them to see whether there are mutations. As you can see that here in TAA1 gene, about 50% of the plant that we genotype has a mutation. And unfortunately, most of the mutations are just heterozygous, means that only one of the parent genotype is mutated. As you can see here in TAA1, some of them have -1 deletion, some of them have -3 or -2 deletion. In the RFA, we actually have gotten even in T0, gotten the homozygous mutations.
Okay. Maybe speed up a little bit.
So then we go to the next generation, we collect the seeds from those plants and look generation in the T1 generation. And here again, looking at the Cas9, you can see that some of the transgenic plant has lost the transgene, like number 13 has lost the transgene, but the other ones still maintain the transgene in them because of segregation of the foreign gene. But then with our supplies, we see a huge number of plants now have that deletion, has that minus 110 deletion because the both sGRA are working. And cutting out a chunk of DNA of that size, we can see that. So you can see just by genotyping, a lot of plants, not only heterozygous, but some of them are homozygous for the deletion. So and number 13 actually has one mutation, you know, minus one mutation, and they have lost the transgene. So in some way, it's a non-transgenic plant that has an edited mutation.
Okay,
so what about the phenotype? And what we found is that in the ARF mutations, homozygous mutations, the signaling grow a lot faster compared with the heterozygous or wild type. These are two different transgenic lines. So that's really interesting. Maybe the ARFA encodes a repressor of oxygen signaling. Right now, these plants are just starting to flower. So we are looking forward to look at the fruit phenotypes, if that's what we're really interested in. So in summary, we have demonstrated that CRISPR works in strawberry. It's actually pretty high efficiency. And we think that it's going to be a powerful tool for generating mutations. And then we are now currently trying to take the custom jar and put it into cultivated strawberry to see whether we can cut off all A copies. So that's where we are now. And I'd like to thank the people who did the work. The RNA-seq work I mentioned earlier is mostly done by a postdoc, Chen Yu-Kang. She's now a professor at the Huazhong Agricultural University in China. And Courtney Han and Durham is here. She's our fifth speaker. She also worked on the RNA-seq data. And so she's my first student working on strawberry, helping set up the strawberry system. And then also collaborating here, Jenna Sloan is here, and also Magdalena Hukal-Booth. We started the initial RNA-seq work together with NSF funding. Really like to thank NSF funding for this project, and also Jun Hui Zhou, who is the postdoc who did the CRISPR work. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. We don't have time for questions, so she'll be here, so you can ask her later. You can move on.